Morning is United States against Willis and Trout.
Good morning. May it please the court. Because the government has conceded error in the sentencing of Mr. Willis, I want to focus my comments on the manner in which the jury was selected in this trial.
Well, you should not necessarily take it for granted that the concession will be accepted.
Understood, Your Honor. And if the court has questions on that issue, I'm certain.
Well, I certainly do. The prosecutor's brief doesn't cite a single authority. Therefore, one wonders whether the confession is well taken. The question I have is, what is the normal rule in the guidelines where the tables list some aggravating or mitigating factor? That aggravating factor happens twice. Take, for example, a bank robbery. There's an entry in the bank robbery table that says, if the defendant shoots a teller or shoots somebody else, add so many levels. Suppose the defendant shoots two tellers. How many levels get added?
Your Honor, I wouldn't presume to be well-educated enough to comment on
that
specific
scenario. That's the critical question. I can't see any reason why the two levels for obstruction of justice would be different from the way other additions and subtractions in the guideline table operate. So the question that's really on the table here is, if there's some provision in the guidelines for adding or subtracting levels, and you do the thing that triggers that more than once, what happens? Do you get multiple additions or not? I can understand an argument for multiple additions. It's the district court's argument. Or I can understand an argument that just says, add once per the table, and if you want to do more than that, just go outside the guideline. I can understand that argument, too, but it's a argument about which of these judges are supposed to do.
And, Your Honor, I think I would point to the technical expertise of the U.S. Probation Office, which interpreted the guidelines.
We do not defer to the probation office's interpretation. Surely this is an issue that has come up in this circuit for other guidelines or in other circuits for this guideline or others. It can't be just a matter of first impression. That the United States' brief is shocking. There's a very important question of guideline construction on which the United States cites not a single authority of any kind.
Your Honor, what we have cited is the particular application of this guideline, Section 3C1.1, which has been applied repeatedly and interpreted consistent with what
it hasn't. I looked up the cases you cited. They don't say two levels is the maximum. They just report that in a particular case, the district court added two levels. They don't say that was legally the only correct thing to do.
No,
that's the question I'm asking. What is legally the correct thing to do?
Well, in the Madison decision, Your Honor, this court did say, quote, that the district court's application of the enhancement was proper, close quote. And I think that the text of that rule, Your Honor, envisions that if obstruction of justice occurs, whether it may be the hiding of evidence, perjury, if that occurs during the course of the case.
Look, this guideline is, obviously, this guideline is just identical in structure to all of the other aggravating and mitigating factors. Back to the bank robbery. There's a provision for adding levels if the defendant fires a gun. Right? So what happens if on the way into the bank, the defendant fires the gun at a guard? And on the way out of the bank, the defendant fires the gun at a police officer? Is that two additions or just one addition? Not a question of just saying the guideline says X extra levels if you fire the gun. We need to know whether that can be applied multiple times. This has got to be the subject of some litigation or interpretation. There may be something the commission has said about it, but you don't cite anything the commission has said about it. The prosecutor doesn't cite anything the commission has said.
In this particular application, Your Honor, we have not
identified. I can't believe this, that the obstruction of justice application, enhancement would be treated any differently from the others. I'm perfectly happy to receive any authority you have about what courts or the commission have said about the other enhancements. That's why I'm using a bank robbery.
I understand, Your Honor. I can't answer the court's question as to whether there exists authority in other applications or not with regard to multiple instances as covered by a particular guideline setting. I can only speak to this one. And if we'd have found it, Your Honor, we would have brought it to the court's attention to be sure. On the issue of jury selection, Batson is all about ensuring the public's confidence in our judicial system. I don't think people who have been involved...
Any objection based on Batson ever made in the district court?
A formal objection was not made, Your Honor, and I...
Mr.
Willis conceded that.
What more is there to argue? You can't run the Batson procedure, which is prima facie case, and then the prosecutor makes an explanation without an objection.
Your Honor, as a practical matter, that it did occur. And everything that the government would be expected to articulate in voicing its non-pretextual basis was presented to the judge. And the judge said, you know, I hadn't thought of that to begin with, but I agree. I'd be concerned, too. You don't want to jeopardize your chances at this conviction. You want to keep this person on the jury. So, therefore, you know, I'd listen to a Batson challenge, but it wouldn't be well taken. As a practical matter, Your Honor, we would be in the same position if a formal objection had been made. And I don't think there should be any doubt about that. Ultimately, too, this court has, in prior instances, acknowledged that a formal objection may not have been articulated, but can be reached. That was the Stevens case, as well as the Jones decision. I'm already into my rebuttal time, which I would like to reserve a brief portion of with the court's leave.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. McDade. Goldman.
Good morning, Your Honors. During the trial, two officers testified as to an alleged incriminating statement, for lack of a better word, a confession, supposedly made by defendant Trout. The interrogator was an officer by the name of Sofrenovich. The other officer, Detective Combs, made notes of that interview statement. The rest of the case against Mr. Trout was conceitedly largely circumstantial, almost wholly circumstantial, but for that statement, alleged statement. During the closing arguments, the government's initial argument, the Assistant United States Attorney, Ms. Noller, placed great reference, as would be expected, great reliance and great reference to the alleged incriminating statement. During the defendant's closing argument, Mr. Morris, a defense attorney, was remarking about how thin the case was and got into, of course, the alleged statement and made reference to the notes of Detective Combs, saying that's all the government had. Because Detective Combs had testified that he really had no independent recollection of the interview outside of his notes. During that statement by the defense attorney, prosecutor, assistant United States attorney, in the form of a speaking objection, objected, and he appended the comment that we have no objection to the notes going back. The defense attorney didn't object, but turned around to the judge and said, "Judge, he's interrupting my argument in an improper way, and he knows it." And it was a brief discussion, whereupon the court said, "Well, the notes are in evidence, aren't they?" "No, they're not. They were never offered." Be that as it may, the court says, "Well, the objection is sustained." During the rebuttal argument, that same prosecutor started remarking about how the confession, for lack of a better word, went unchallenged. He said that at least three times in such a manner as to indicate that the only person who really could have challenged it was the defendant. And, of course, the defendant had exercised his constitutional right not to testify. Excuse me. Well, that statement was repeated, words to that effect, on three separate occasions.
What's wrong with it?
When the jury went out...
You know the Supreme Court of the United States in...
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
In United States against Robinson, the Supreme Court of the United States held that there's nothing wrong with a prosecutorial statement of that kind. Why should we disagree with the Supreme Court?
Well, Your Honor, if the court please, in essence, this circuit has, well, not disagreed, but you have United States v. Cotton, an opinion authored by the judge sitting to your right.
Any difference?
It covered the situation.
I'm asking about the decision of the Supreme Court. Are you aware of Robinson? Do you know what it holds?
I am aware of Robinson.
So how is your position compatible with Robinson?
Pardon?
How is your position compatible with the holding of the Supreme Court in Robinson?
Well, the way that the prosecutor in this particular case made the statement, Your Honor, could only mean that the defendant did not testify.
That was Robinson's argument, all right, but he lost.
Your Honor, as I understand it, well, I will not quarrel with the court, but of course, but it just seems that in the case at bar, the prosecutor just played it. That was his whole closing argument. His whole rebuttal argument. Centered around the statement and nothing else. In any event, when the jury went out, the importance of all of this is highlighted by the jury sent out four notes in total. The first two concern the alleged confession. The first one asked to see the notes. Or something like that. Of course, the court couldn't comply with that. The second one asked to see the trial testimony of the two officers. And, of course, that couldn't be complied with. The third note was on inconsistent verdicts. And the fourth one, which is... subject of our last argument, was the jury indicated, well, said that they could not reach unanimity. At that point, the district court, instead of giving the Silvern instruction, paraphrased it in such a manner as to say, well, notwithstanding the law, you sent them back just telling them not to, notwithstanding the law. Prior to that, you told...
Thank you very much, Mr. Volpe. Ms. Zimmer.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Time expired.
May it please the Court, I'm Marnie Zimmer representing the government. First, I'd like to address the sentencing guidelines issue. The government did take a look at the cases and did not find a case addressing this specific issue. We also considered analogous cases and, again, did not find something that we thought addressed
this. When you say this specific issue, do you mean this question for any guideline?
Your Honor, I'm referring, no, to the obstruction of justice, the multiple.
Yeah, well, there are hundreds of these addition and subtraction factors. It's quite believable that this issue wouldn't have come up for this one in particular. But I really would like to know whether it's come up for any of them, because I can't see any reason why this should be treated differently from others.
Your Honor, I'm happy to take another look and submit a supplemental brief. In this case, on the basis of
Has the Commission ever addressed this? I mean, you'd think with the huge number of comments and the immense volume of material, every time they amend the guidelines, the commentary on the amendments balloons. I can't believe the Commission hasn't addressed this question someplace.
Again, I'm not aware that the Commission has addressed it, but I'm happy to take another look.
I think it would very much help if you would file a supplemental memo within 10 days, and if you do that, I will give Mr. Lefebvre 10 days to respond.
Addressing Defendant Trout's argument about the comments during the rebuttal argument, the defendant did not object to those comments, and thus this is examined under a plain error standard. The government's comments during its rebuttal argument were in reference to the defense counsel's statement that Detective Combs, the detective that took the notes during the interview of the defendant and took the notes of the confession of the defendant, was an honest guy. In the government's rebuttal, the prosecutor stated that he was confused by that concession, and he was confused as to whether, given that statement, defense counsel was actually challenging the testimony.
Well, Trout was the only person who could have challenged the testimony, right?
That's correct. There were two detectives in the room, but other than the detectives, Defendant Trout was the only other person in the room.
And then this statement, when the closing argument was taking place at the defense, the objection, but we have no objection to the notes going back. Are you saying that was okay for the prosecutor to add that commentary when the notes were not in evidence and he...
I believe that that statement was proper, given the fact that the defense counsel was improperly implying that the government had the notes and chose not to show it to the jury, and that the prosecutor in this case was trying to correct that implication when he made that speaking objection.
But wasn't the better course to just make the objection, take it to sidebar, and have the court address it?
Perhaps, but I think that even if you assume that that comment was improper, it still does not deprive Defendant Trout of a fair trial, because the judge did instruct the jury.
But what I'm saying is, if there had been just a regular objection, I mean, the prosecutor knew the notes were not in evidence. Unless something magic happened, they were not going to get into evidence at the close of the closing argument. So, you know, I mean, just the court could have done the very same thing, come back, said, look, those notes are not in evidence, can't consider that argument, and moved on. That would have been a better course.
That would have been an alternative. Again, I think given the exact language that defense counsel used, there was a clear implication that he was trying to imply to the jury that the government had chosen not to show these notes to the jury, and he was correcting that implication. And, yes, that would have been another way to remedy that.
In a better way, don't you think?
Yes. if you find that the objection was improper, again, it doesn't deprive defendant Trout of a fair trial. The error by that speaking objection was minimal. The court instructed the jury that the arguments were not evidence, that they were to rely on their own recollection and to disregard arguments not supported by the evidence. In addition, when that objection was made, defense counsel stopped, and the court did address and say, I don't think that the interruption was warranted. So the court did address that objection right at the spot. And then later also instructed the jury, as I just stated. Lastly, on that point, the evidence against Trout was substantial in this case. There were two different detectives that testified as to defendant Trout's confession, the details of the confession. There was also strong circumstantial evidence in this case, including that defendant Trout had access to a tug, which was used to steal the cameras. That was not contested. His supervisor was injured on the night of the robbery. Therefore, he had the opportunity to commit the robbery. There was also objective evidence that his badge swipes showed him swiping in several times and then not swiping for 10 hours, which was the time that the robbery took place in this case. On the issue of the jury note, the court in this handled the jury note here properly. He read the note in open court. The government was present. The defense counsel was present. The defendant was present. He read the complete note and then told the parties how he intended to proceed given this fourth note. Neither party objected. Again, so the standard here is plain error.
Were either of these defendants fugitives at any time?
I don't know.
We wouldn't have a memory problem if the prosecution wasn't for.
I do not know.
All right.
Not only did defense counsel not object when the court indicated its plan to read the note or how to respond to the note, he did not object during the discussion between the court and the jury about the note. He did not object after the note. As for the Batson, defendant Willis's Batson claim, there was no Batson challenge at trial court level, and thus the Batson claim must be reviewed only for plain error. Although defense counsel now argues that for practical purposes there was a Batson claim made, the case law states that a timely specific objection to the use of a peremptory challenge is required because the trial court is almost always in a better position to rule on the objection because they can see the credibility and the demeanor of the prosecutor when he gives his reasons. Because there was no Batson challenge, we don't have a complete record for review. Thus, this plain error also applies in this case, and unless discriminatory intent is inherent in the prosecutor's explanation, the claim fails. In this case, the government brought up the issue to the court outside the presence of the jury, stating that it was sensitive because there was only one minority veneer member, and it had questions about the circumstances of her leaving her last place of employment. This was important to the government, as it stated, because this case involved an employee stealing from an employer. The court denied the request for further questions. He said, if you want to make a Batson violation, I will listen. Defense counsel did not make such a claim. Again, as I stated, the juror was the only juror that was unemployed for reasons unknown to the government. There was no discriminatory intent in the prosecutor's explanation. I'd like to just touch briefly again on the comments during the rebuttal argument. And I know I talked about this a little bit before, but given that the prosecutor was struggling with the defense counsel's statement that this detective was an honest guy, the prosecutor did not manifestly intend to refer to defendant's silence, nor did the jury take the prosecutor's comments as a comment on defendant's silence. And this is evidenced by the fact that defense counsel did not object to these statements or move for a mistrial, even though he was objecting and moving for a mistrial on other grounds. Even if the court found these comments improper, any error was modest and would not be enough to meet the plain error standard. The court minimized any error with instructions regarding the burden of proof, the defendant's right not to testify, and as I stated previously, the evidence in this case was substantial as to defendant Trout. There are no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Zimmer. Anything further, Mr. LaFay?
I'll tell you what I got, Your Honor.
Absolutely.
The government just stated that this was a case involving the theft from an employer. That's not true. It was goods that were being shipped via American Airlines. The theft was not to the employer. Therefore, I don't see any logic, and it's not certainly not apparent, the logic in saying that because the person was not employed, there necessarily would be a logical connection and a concern that was not driven by race.
Yeah, but I thought they were. Didn't she work at some fast food place as a manager or something, and then that employment terminated, and there was no explanation as to what the termination was?
We don't know from the record, right, Your Honor, why she left Subway. She could have had an extended illness. She may have decided to quit. She may have been asked to leave.
And she may have had some other kind of misconduct issue. Unknown.
It is possible. It requires speculation based on the record before the court and as well before the lower court. Unquestionably.
And the district court didn't allow inquiry.
That's right. And, you know, if it was so obvious that there was this connection, why would the government have asked for further questions? Clearly, the government felt that it did not have the evidence, the facts, the particulars to make a persuasive argument on a race-neutral basis based on the record that had been developed during voir dire. And it is also, I think, hard to ignore the practical reality that you had a black defendant whose primary defense was that his confession had been coerced by white police officers and the only member of his race was struck from the panel. That clearly would raise a question about the evenness of the playing field and the perception of unfairness, and therefore,
I think we have your position.
Thank you,
Mr. LaFave. We appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment and the assistance you've been both to your client and the court. Now, with respect to the supplemental filings on this multiple on the multiple enhancing factors, you know, I've been spending part of my time during this argument seeing if I could get some help out of the guideline manual, Part 1B. I mean, there are several provisions in Part 1B, 1.2, and 1.3 that concern generally how these extra factors are added and subtracted. But there's an awful lot of text there that I haven't read. Maybe it will be helpful, but 1B, 1.2, I think 1B, 1.3, may give you some entree. My suspicion is that it's an answer, first, that it must be out there, and second, that it almost certainly concerns all of the additions and subtractions, not just anything particular to it.
I understand the court's,
okay.
The court's thoughts.
Good. Thank you very much. We will look forward to those submissions. The case is taken under advisement.